outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
Well, I'm back. Yep, this is not from the archive. This is live and in color. Well, as much color as you get by audio. But this is me, finally back from a bit of travel, a bit of helping out my family through a difficult time, a bit of trying to get a book done that I hoped to have had done 6 months ago. And today we're just packaging everything off and getting it to the production people. And that means my hands go off of it, and I don't get to fix anything anymore, add anything anymore, change anything anymore, and that's always difficult for me. I can massage and edit and redo, and I can do that forever. I actually enjoy that part of the writing process, but at some point, you got to let her go, and today we're letting it go. Hi, I'm Wayne Jacobson, and I want to welcome you to this new edition of The God Journey, since it's been a while since we've done that. Appreciate your patience and all. And have appreciated all of your prayers for the times that we've been. I've gotten tons of email, cards, letters, people caring about our family as we've gone through the loss of my mom. And, you know, it's been a difficult season, as those seasons are, and saying goodbye, even though this was attendant with an awful lot of grace. This was not a surprise. It was not a shock. It was my mother's body wearing out. And there was a real sense of grace in the process and presence and timing. And it just seemed like it was so right for her to move on to the age to come. And yet we'll miss her. My daughter, my son, my grandkids, going to miss her a ton. The family, my dad will, and just the way God arranged things, we were able to spend a month with my dad. I got up there for a couple of weeks of trying to finish the book and then a couple of weeks of just taking some time off. And we got there the day before my mom passed away. She passed away the morning after we had arrived. And so we got to be with dad through the whole process of, man, if you've been through it, you know, the paperwork, the lawyers, the all that has to be done. There's that, as well as all the emotional things to deal with in that season, as well as all that we all have, I guess, these complicated family arrangements that death and bringing everybody together. No, my family's not perfect. People may have a very false view of those things. Some of that stuff was incredibly difficult, but God was with us. We've navigating through it. It's still an ongoing process. I appreciate every one of you that's written and loved up on us and sent a card or sent an email or something. We've been really touched by all that. And mom's service that we had a celebration thing, she was really clear about not having a funeral or memorial service. She wanted a celebration of her life. We did that. And my brother made an incredible video. We'll link it here if you haven't seen it. I did put it on the blog earlier, but if you haven't seen it and want to see it, particularly if you knew my mom, it's kind of a whole experience of the family sharing life with her. Death is, and I tell you, maybe I'm just more aware of it, or it seemed like this summer, a lot of people, a lot of my relationships on Facebook, friendships, people have lost parents. We're kind of that age, I guess, where our parents are kind of fading away, some of us. And so I know I'm not the only one that's dealt with that. I know lots of other people have as well. And that, again, invites lots of stuff. And one thing I've noticed from that, and as well from some of you were part of, you know, the kind of the cover dialogue for the new book I've been working on. We had some geese, some eyeballs, some people, and we had lots of people kind of giving me input on that. I got probably close to 1,000 responses the time I add up all the email and blog comments and comments on Facebook. And that was all incredibly helpful to me. It was. But both those two experiences, my mother dying and watching what people are writing to me, the book covers, and boy, you just see how much we're all over the map. What people anticipate, what people expect, what people think is going to be helpful, how they dealt with grief when they went through it, and how they think we should. What book cover is the right one and no other one should be considered? And it's just funny to me how much our personal preferences get expressed oftentimes in black and white, right and wrong terminology. Like, this is the right thing. This is the way grief will come at you, and this is what you need to do. And you know, I live in a life and a world that's far more nuanced than that. And that's not to say I don't appreciate all the input I got, because I did on both scores. But I would appreciate, I think, and maybe this is helpful to other people. It doesn't bother me. I'm fine getting it however it comes. But I do think there's a way to posture our language, which can share our experience and wisdom without making it about right and wrong. I think that's one of the things religion's done to us. Everything's about what's right and what's wrong, and we get into that mode, and we don't realize how nuanced life is and how much some of the things we think are right and wrong or the way everybody should do it or everybody will do it because that's what happened to me doesn't give room for this incredible individuality of life and how each of us process stuff very differently. And how my grief may not be like yours at all, or what I'm dealing with in the situation. And I know there are assumptions made because I went through it that way, and that's how I see it. But if you can, I think this is, I hope this is a good learning experience. Honestly, it's not despising anything anyone sent to me or any comment someone made on book covers. Just kind of open my eyes again to that fresh reality of how much is a matter of personal opinion that we get thinking is right or wrong, or that our preference is a universal preference, or the way God deals with me in a situation is the way God ought to deal with everybody. And I think I love more embodied conversations than that. I like people who go, you know, this is what I went through, and this is what was helpful to me. What are you going through, and what's helpful to you? And you find yourself into a conversation that has greater layers of meaning and depth than simply we all think and process the same way, or we all should. And if there's anything that would spell that out, it would be something like grief over death of a loved one. I mean, there's just a billion ways to process that. I was reminded of someone that lost their husband after, I think it was close to 50 years, if it wasn't over 50 years. And she told me, she wrote me a note. And I've known this lady for a long time. Her husband was a significant person in my life at one season. And after he died, she's sitting in church. And it's probably been 3 months now after he'd passed away. And something in the service just reminded her of him. And she found herself teared up and just taking a moment, even though service had already been dismissed, taking a moment, sitting in her pew, just trying to gather herself and sort out that emotion. And one of the staff pastor guys walked by and noticed her in tears and sat down and said, "You okay?" And she said, "I'm just thinking about my husband today," or something. He goes, again, 3 months out, and his answer is, "Oh, you're still wrestling with that?" Now, I realize that most people aren't that stupid and insensitive and difficult, but some people are, because maybe for them, they get over stuff in a month or two. Grief can last, oh gosh, it can last a long time. I got a dear brother yesterday who we've had on this podcast, Jack Gray from New Zealand now. He's just crossing the anniversary of his wife's passing. I'm guessing now 8 or 9 years ago. He talks about living in the valley of the shadow of death. And he's aware every day that a major part of his life isn't with him anymore, as my dad will be now. But how we process that is so incredibly unique. And what cover we might love is so incredibly unique to it. And I shared a little bit on my blog the other day, but the thing I was wrestling with the cover was this. And it wasn't, somebody accused me of, this is a great advertisement for your book. And if it felt that way, I got a yuck factor over that, because that wasn't my idea, but it sure may have been what it looked like, or it sure may have been, it may have that effect. I don't know. But I had this geese cover. I've used it all along. I like it. It's a great cover. I like the geese analogy, but the geese analogy didn't play into this book. And every time I tried to put it in somewhere, I've used it in other cases, but this book is very different than that. And the geese just didn't seem to work for me, though as a picture of the body of Christ, I know it works for a lot of people. And so we tried to do some other things, and they didn't do it right, and I just kept struggling. We had some inklings and ideas, and I was exploring it with people I knew, and my artist guy probably drove him nuts. I love Dave's great guy. I feel bad for putting him through this process, because at the end of the day, I've got to love it. I've got to love a cover. The only cover I haven't loved I won't say the only one. Let me say there's been two. There's only one in print today that I didn't love. From the first time the publisher showed it to me, I went, wow, this is a horrible cover. Not even just a horrible design, which I thought it was, but it was also a horrible for the electronic age, because it was the title is so small, you can't read it in the thumbnail, it gets lost. And it was just at the advance. It's Authentic Relationships. It's probably the book that has sold the least, but where it has sold, I get incredible letters from people where people have read it because it's all about moving this he loves me relationship horizontal. How do we live out this one anothering? And how do relationships happen, grow, and deepen? And so when people actually read it, they love it, but people look at the cover and I think they kind of get a little uppy-chucky in their throat or whatever and decide, hey, I don't need to read that. Covers mean a lot. They really do. But I want to love it. I want to love a cover. And because I don't work with a publisher now that can ram a cover down my throat, I get to do the cover I want. And so we did that. Let me tell you what. We'll have a link to it, I guess, if you haven't seen it already. It's a little out there. It's a bit abstract. It's not, you know, something like geese flying in the wind and freedom and all that. But the nature of the book is, how is God causing a new creation to rise in this age where brothers and sisters don't relate to each other the same way we do in the old creation, where it's not about managing jealousies and selfishness and desires for power, and we create systems to do all that, where it's brothers and sisters who genuinely, with affection, love each other and are learning to share each other's interests as well as their own. And I don't know of the system that manages that. I think rather than this is how we do that, I think what Scripture says is you can't do that. Let me build my church. I will build it. You all learn to become disciples. You all help others become, teach people how to live in me, how to follow me. And where they do that, the church will take shape because it's a different way of living together. And that's what the book's about. How out of each of our individual journeys, God spins us together. The breath, wind of his spirit strings us in together, knits us together in a way that causes, and I've been part of, for the last 20 years, part of the most incredible expressions of church life I could ever have conceived of. And none of them are building. You can't call me and say, well, I'd love to visit someday. What are you going to visit? I have people I know. And to the degree that we share a journey of mutual love, respect, and interest, where we listen to God together, the church takes shape. It's that simple. And where we don't, where we try and start something together, and I get that email all the time, you know, we want to start something different. And I think that's the first step down a road that says we're going to build it instead of let him build. Why do we start something? Why don't we be intentional about the relationships God's putting in our lives, and with that intentionality, become those who live deeply in him? What I love about the cover, it's this whirlwind of different threads being spun together into some glorious, lovely whole. And I see that as the church in the world. And most people, when I put the cover up, they went, I don't know what this is, but I'm intrigued by it. And I know people who haven't read the book, they're not going to get that. But I'm hoping it's intriguing enough. I don't think the book's going to sell because of the cover anyway. I think the book will find its way in the world simply because people are hungry to find church. And they're hungry to say if there really is something more. I had a theological student, a thinker who read the book, who's for years tried to get me to routinize my view of church into a structure that others can emulate. And he was reading some of the advanced copies of the material, and he's saying at the end of it, he said, I don't know of a person, just having read the first chapter, which I read to you a few weeks ago, I don't know any person that would read that chapter that hasn't sat through a Sunday morning service with those thoughts. My goodness, is this what Jesus had in mind? Wouldn't the church of Jesus Christ expressing it in the world be something entirely different? So we're finally getting ready to produce that. I'm pretty excited, mostly not because, hey, it's my new book. Everybody's got to see it. I'm excited about this material being in the conversation. And the feedback I'm getting from people I've shared it with is no one else is talking this way, which in the publishing industry is scary. I mean, they like taking what's already sold, redo it, and try and sell it again. That man, they don't care. That's why there's so many marriage books or so many books on how to do church from a structural standpoint, because people like the same thing. And every couple of years, they want to read another book on the same thing, even if it's not going to be helpful. And so I know that's scary because no one's talking like this and kind of measuring church this way. But the people I know in the world and the people I love, the people who are walking this journey out, the feedback I'm getting from them, the resonance in their heart with what's there, I'm pretty excited about it. So it's going to press. We are planning to have copies around October 15th in hand. And so we've put pre-orders up. People just keep badging. I want to order this thing now. I want to order it now. So just get it as soon as it's off the press. So we're going to do that now. And we put up a pre-order page. So people that want to pre-order the book, you're welcome to do that. But and there will be ebook versions come out about the same time around October 15th. So if you're an ebook person, hold on. You don't have to order a paperback copy. But as we said earlier in the podcast, and we're not announcing this on the website at all, but if you listen to the podcast, of the pre-orders that we get, we're shipping two books to every person who orders. So if you order one, we're shipping you two. Now, if you order 10, we're not shipping you 20, but we're matching the first one. Just to give you something to share with someone else and hopefully helps that spread in the world a little bit. So that'll be going on. Trust us to do it. It's not anywhere on the order blank, so don't get nervous when you see it that way because we're going to do it even for people who don't listen to the podcast. You don't have to ask for it. We're just going to do it on the pre-orders. And we may do it a bit longer if we find that it's helpful for people and a blessing. If it's just an extra book that gets thrown away, not too excited about wasting paper. So, and then the ebook, obviously, we can't do the same thing, but you may want a copy of this one. You may want to pass it on to somebody. You may want to circle some things, highlight some things. That's the only thing I find cumbersome in the ebook world, but that's enough from all that. What I wanted to do today, because I have honestly, after my vacation, it's been dead on every day, all day, getting the manuscript edited, making what changes I need to make, pulling in all the inside materials, getting all ready to go to the publisher, getting the cover decided, cover copy decided, all that stuff. I've got a ton of stuff here for a podcast. People have sent me stuff. I've got links. I got all kinds of stuff here, but I haven't had a moment to even think through it. So I thought the best thing I could do, because I didn't want you to wait any longer for a new podcast, so I'm just going to read you chapter two. And now you'll have almost 10% of the book in. And then we'll hopefully get the rest of it out. Maybe even read you another chapter as we get close. So I'm going to read chapter two. It's titled The Community of a New Creation. The scripture, I am making everything new, from Revelation 21:5. I know what they mean, but the language still jars me. They left the church, or I left the church 10 years ago. Since they've continued to passionately follow Jesus, I want to correct them. You may have left your congregation, but how did you leave the church? Do you think you can belong to him and not be part of his family? It's one of the tragic consequences of using the term to describe the myriad of religious institutions that dot our landscape instead of the tapestry of his people Jesus is weaving together. When Scripture talks about the church, it does so with a profound sense of wonder as the crowning glory of God's work in human history. In addition to being the spotless bride, unstained by the world, Paul also says she is his body, the fullness who fills everything in every way. What an incredible picture. A family taking shape in the world that expresses everything he is. None of us could do that on our own, but the synergy of our care and cooperation can replicate his nature and glory. This has been God's desire from the beginning, to bring all things together under one head, to Jesus himself, Ephesians 1:10. That unity of heart and purpose will further display the manifold wisdom of God to the rulers and authorities in heavenly realms, Ephesians 3:10. As we become more one with him, each of us will reflect a bit of his glory. When we connect with others who are also being shaped by him, we find an immediate oneness and affection as we recognize his life in them. The way we love one another, the unity with which we pray, and the combining of our gifts and resources to do the tasks he gives us to do will reveal his nature not only to people around us, but will actually undermine the unseen spiritual forces that seek to destroy humanity. Anyone who beats with God's heart yearns to engage this family. Granted, you may not have seen that reality in the groups you've been a part of in the past, but that doesn't mean she doesn't exist. This community is growing to trust him and the way he works, and they are learning the simple joy of living in the Father's affection and sharing it with others. You'll find it where people lay down their lives for each other, where they don't fight to be first or thought more spiritual, and where they would rather be defrauded than push for their own way. As they relate together under his leading, the church becomes the most exciting, functional family ever. If we start there, then our conventional definition of the church as a religious institution is unworkable. How could we ever produce such a thing? A group doesn't take on that reality simply because it calls itself a church. We've attached the word that was meant to unveil the glory of the Father's family to institutions that are capable of reflecting it for any sustained period. That's why when we use the word church for any collection of people who self-identify as Christians, we miss that reality. They may do many of the things we'd expect a church to do, teach the gospel, encourage fellowship, and reach out to the lost. But they begin by staking out their beliefs, by forcing a meeting structure, decision-making process, and their mission. They try to make people good Christians by getting them to conform to those plans and expectations with varying degrees of pressure and with varying degrees of success. The fact that we have hundreds of thousands of such groups all claiming to be the church and that they have so little in common renders the term meaningless. Jesus' church is not a human creation. Rather, it is the fruit of the relationships of those who are part of a new creation, the redeemed race of humanity that relates to him as the head. When Paul tells us that the church is the fullness of Christ, he's moving beyond a collection of Christians and talking about a vibrant community that lives at his pleasure and as his complement in the world. The church Jesus is building has been growing since the day he inaugurated it at Pentecost. It's not a meeting or an institution per se, but a growing family. It takes shape wherever people who are engaged with him interact with one another. And rather than thinking of it as a group to join, it might be better to look for that reality in the conversations, connections, and collaborations he gives us each day. As you will see, it can appear almost anywhere at any time. Wherever two or three who are following Jesus are together, you have a functioning family. I nearly fell out of the pew the first time I heard that line. It came out of the mouth of the senior pastor of the first staff position I'd ever held while he was teaching through Matthew. I'm not sure he believed it, given his focus on commitment and accountability to the institution he led. I didn't either at the time. But I think Jesus does, and that's why when this 24-year-old associate pastor heard it, his heart soared. What if it's true? And what if it provides a better understanding of the church than the one most of us have been given? The church of the new creation is more like wildflowers strewn across an alpine meadow than a walled garden with manicured hedges. I realize such a seemingly amorphous view of the church will make many nervous, especially those who think it is their God-given duty to manage a group of people on his behalf, or else the church cannot exist. But it can. And I'm not advocating for the isolated, everyone's a church to themselves idea. The church takes her expression in relationships we have with others who are also following him, local friendships, as well as international connections that he knits together. We'll first see it reflected in conversations where Jesus makes himself known. Some of those conversations will grow into more enduring friendships that become part of the fabric of our lives as we serve, encourage, and grow together. These friendships will lead to others, and out of that network of friends and friends of friends, God will have all the resources he needs to invite us to agreement in prayer and collaborative action to fulfill his purpose in the world. Can it really be that simple? This is perhaps the greatest stumbling block to people seeing the church for what she is. It's too simple, they think, or too easy. So they put their trust in the vast array of discordant institutions instead of the work of Jesus. As we'll see, connecting is difficult only because it is far easier than we dare believe. In fact, you probably have those growing connections with people, even in the congregation you attend. I'm only suggesting that your interaction with them expresses more freely the life of the church than sitting in a pew watching the staged activity up front. Admittedly, this discussion about church is not easy to have. Most people want simple, clear answers to heavily nuanced realities. It would be easier to say that all religious institutions are bad and smaller, more informal groups are good, except that it isn't true. If we just had an organization that represented the one true church led by the right people, then we would know who is in and who is out, except that every group who's ever tried it has ended up arrogant and abusive in trying to keep it pure. So we are going to have to make a distinction in our minds between the church that humanity has attempted to build for 2,000 years and the community of the new creation that Jesus is building. They are not the same, though they can gloriously overlap on occasion. It's just that our conformity-based structures cannot produce the internal transformation necessary for the church to take shape among us. And as much as we can see how our congregational doctrines, rituals, and structures can fail us, I'm not saying they're evil. This isn't a matter of whether these are good or bad, but how we use them. If they enhance our growing relationship with God, great. It's when they become a substitute for the relationship we lack that they are problematic. I agree with the theology of the historic creeds, and reading them inspires me. It's not our mental assent that's important, however, but living inside the truths they espouse. Likewise, ritual can open our hearts into a wider world and help us reflect on Him. Or it can become meaningless repetition that only makes us feel more distant from the living God. And I'm not against structure, which is incredibly valuable wherever it gives shape to whatever Jesus is doing among a group of people. Everything I do has structure, from the books I publish to the travel I arrange to our work in Africa with orphans and widows. Structure is essential to coordinate people to accomplish specific tasks. But history shows us that no group structure can successfully reflect the life of Jesus for very long. It happens subtly, but over time people end up serving the structure. They become dependent on it instead of following Him. In the end, however, no creed, ritual, or structure can contain the church Jesus is building. And strangely enough, neither do any of those things exclude the possibility of the church taking shape. Because the church takes expression wherever people are learning to live alongside Jesus in the new creation. It can appear almost anywhere. It's a family, and that family is defined by the nature of relationships of love to one another. Years ago, a friend offered me a challenge. Why don't we only use the term church the way Paul talks about her in the scriptures? Let's call the church what he calls the church and not be distracted by the institutions that use the term for something less than the reality. It hasn't been easy. Common usage trips me up all the time, but I do think the word is worth preserving as a term of endearment so that when we read the scriptures, it will evoke the church Jesus had in mind. I'm going to endeavor to do that here. Rather than using the term for any collection of Christians that meet together in an established system, I'll use the term church to describe the family of God that Jesus is putting on display. When I talk about institutions, I'm going to use the words congregation or fellowship. And when, because of popular usage, I have no choice but to use the word church, such as church split, for that which is not truly the church, I'll set it off with quotes. For the past 20 years, I have been privileged to be part of a growing conversation with people all over the world who are losing their confidence that an institution can provide the environment the Church of Jesus Christ needs to flourish. Some of us have already left institutionalized Christianity, either because we were pushed out for asking the wrong questions or because we could no longer continue to serve the demands of an institution that seems so at odds with the growing passion in our heart. None of us did so easily, having spent decades serving in local congregations and engaged in multiple efforts to reform them. In the end, we left not to abandon our faith, but to explore that faith on a more vibrant journey than those structures would allow. Many others share the same concerns, but are still engaged institutionally, either because they're hopeful of finding an institutional solution or because they're simply making the best of a system for which they see no plausible alternative. Many of these are pastors and elders who know better than anyone else the constant struggle between the institutional needs and living the priorities of Jesus' kingdom. Others stay for fear of being alienated from family and friends. To be clear, I'm not writing this book for those who are comfortable in the institutions we've inherited in the 21st century, but for those who have the nagging feeling that there must be something more than the church as we've come to know it. If you're hoping I'll give people 10 reasons why they have to go to a local congregation, you will be disappointed. If you're looking for me to condemn the well-intended people who are trying to make our religious institutions work as well as they can, I won't do that either. Well, I'm convinced that no system can replicate the life of the church among a group of people. I have seen the reality of His church expressed in relationships there as well. And if you're looking for a how-to guide so you can build a better model of the church where you live, you might as well stop reading here. You're about to discover that's not your job and your best efforts can't replicate it. Finally, if you hoped for a church bashing book, you won't find it here. I love the church Jesus is building. this amazing network of people who are learning to live in him. I've seen expressions of her almost everywhere, in a chance encounter on a plane, in a conversation with a neighbor, with a network of friends who live near me, or collaborating on a project with gracious and generous people. It will not help us to split into adversarial groups, one that champions the local congregations and those that condemn it. Hasn't there been enough division in this family over things that don't truly matter? My hope for the church includes them both, because in the end, it isn't about the meetings we attend or avoid, but whether we are coming alive in his kingdom and sharing that life with others in whatever format he places us. Wouldn't it serve the purposes of Jesus more if we could reach beyond the places and people we prefer to embrace the expression of his family however she makes herself known? Where we begin, however, is not by trying to fix our congregations, but looking toward our own awakening inside a new creation. This is where church life begins, and the only environment in which the church can take shape. I don't think any of us can yet conceive of what this church will look like when thousands upon thousands of people freely live in the reality of Jesus' love and respond to the voice of the shepherd simultaneously and spontaneously around the world. How well would we love each other and the people around us if we no longer had divisive institutions separating us or exhausting us with their meetings and activities? I'm convinced love will do far more to unfold the kingdom of God on earth than any project or outreach we could devise. The church Jesus is building is the one that you've been longing for, and that is why the human version of it has been so frustrating. I hope this book provides a catalyst for the conversation that this church desperately needs if we're going to reflect his glory in the world. Okay, that's chapter 2. Chapter 3 goes on from there, and I don't know what we'll do next. There's another chapter. I'm actually thinking about reading chapter 17 sometime, because I think those are a good sample of where this thing goes. It only is going to have value, though. The book is not going to be something that's contained in itself, and here's the 7 keys to go do whatever. It's here's how to recognize the church, and if it doesn't spawn a bigger conversation in your life and bigger opportunities to touch people, then you might get to find it a bit disappointing. So I hope I get enough email to say people really appreciate reading some of that, so that's why I do it. I don't do it to frustrate you that the rest of it isn't available. I've been in this thing, as I said, for a year. I'm excited to get some of the material out there and available, and this is my way of sharing it with people who've been alongside me in this process and see where it goes. Next week, I think Brad's going to join me. We've got that on the schedule anyway. We'll see if it happens. And please keep in mind the folks we've been loving and serving in Africa and Kenya. There's a whole project now of trying to create some industry beyond the petrol station we began to help this group of people find a way to be self-sustaining, that God can provide for them with the work of their own hands. So rather than continuing to be dependent here, I thought initially that was going to cost us about $14,000. We got some decimal points wrong when it came my way. It's about $140,000, but it will create a grain distribution business where they can buy grain at the harvest time when it's cheap, store it, resell it at the higher prices at the non-harvest times. It'll help, A, feed the people they need to feed. Two, the profits that generates will take not only the remaining balance of the orphanage need, but also help fund some of the schools and things up in the North Pokot region where we just added a new well. We've got 4 wells up there now for one group that was just too far away to access the other 3. Obviously, every community would like a well in their neighborhood, and I just don't think that that's ours to do. I think we've got enough of them spread out right now. Maybe that need may represent itself. And the stories of people who are coming to faith in that region just out of the generosity of you folks makes this a complete joy to be involved in. So hopefully next week we're going to get back into a more regular mode. I've got some of the family issues behind me. Now I've got the book finished, although there'll be still lots of work to do to get it to the printer, actually, in 3 weeks' time. And then we'll be set to go. So, well, thanks for hanging with us through our little hiatus time. We're going to try to have a little more consistent podcasting here up the road. I did find that some people really enjoyed wandering back to the archives, the one about chocolate touched the funny bone of many. I enjoyed this letter from Cameron. Got it just earlier this week. I just finished listening to the Bicycle Podcast. That one's called Living Loved and Riding Bikes. It's an old one that Brad and I did. I'll link it here. My heart feels 50 pounds lighter. It seems like sometimes I forget that I have access to a bike at all, and I start huffing and puffing, running my hardest and getting exhausted. My heart retreats into a shell, and my relationship with him gets hard. But a bike is so much easier than running, and when I come back to his love for me, I smile up into his face again. Then life doesn't seem so tedious and stressful anymore. Thanks for reminding me that fellowship with him is not hard and that it is fun. Thanks, Cameron. I'm glad you found it. There's lots of stuff back there. Brad and I sharing the life of Jesus together. Hopefully, we'll have him here next week.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com or add your voice by calling our comment line at 805-539-6980.